Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But if the giant bubble is searching for a pin, and it's going to find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stock.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. Welcome aboard to another edition of Wall Street Unspun. This is Wednesday, November 2nd. And I am coming to you live from my Newport Beach office. It's been some time since I've been out at the West Coast office. Most of the time I'm doing this show, I'm doing it from the Darien office. Actually, I'm usually doing it from my home because I'm doing it at 8 o'clock in the evening, East Coast time, and I'm already home. But here I'm still in the office. It's 5 o'clock out here on the West Coast, and I will be heading back to the East Coast office tomorrow. In any event, the telephone number to call, and I definitely invite all of your calls this evening. The number to call is 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597 for your call, for your questions, for your comments. And the lines are open. I don't know that we have any callers yet. Yeah, the lines are open, so please call 888-678-9597. Well, you know, I think it's been a relatively uneventful week since last Wednesday. I don't know that there's been any new events coming out. I know the other day we saw Barrick Gold making a hostile or unsolicited bid for Placer Dome, which is an interesting development. Many of our clients own shares of both of those companies. I have a significant position in both of them myself. Also, Goldcorp is involved in the deal because Barrick had made a deal with Goldcorp to sell off part of Placer Dome's assets to Goldcorp for cash. And again, I have a significant position there, as well as a number of our clients own those stocks. And it's interesting, we're finally seeing some consolidation again in the gold mining business. I mean, Barrick Gold has long been rumored to be interested in Placer Dome. And it just seemed like the right time. Barrick Gold came out with very good earnings a day or two before this announcement. And if you look at the price difference between the shares of Barrick and the shares of Placer Dome, Barrick Gold shares were trading at a substantial premium to Placer Dome, and so it made sense at that time for Barrick to make an offer, given their currency, their own shares, had appreciated so much relative to the shares of Placer Dome. But what's very interesting about it, from our point of view, is it, you know, shows more consolidation in the mining industry, which ultimately is bullish for the price of gold. You know, as competitors leave the scene and merge, you know, they get some economies of scale, but generally it means in total maybe there'll be less production and the price of gold could be higher. I think it also shows that Barrick is bullish on gold going forward, and they're certainly looking to increase their reserves. And I think more and more companies, given the high cost of mining these days and the high cost of exploration, I think a lot of gold companies will be looking towards smaller companies as a way to augment their reserves. If this deal goes through, Barrick Gold will supplant Newmont Mining and become the largest gold miner in the world. So it is possible that, you know, potentially Newmont or maybe Anglo Gold out of South Africa might step up and try to make a better deal for Placer Dome. So far, that hasn't happened, but you never know. But that's been an interesting development. The price of gold, interestingly enough, sold off. I mean, as soon as that deal was announced, gold was down about $7 or $8 that day, another $5 or $6 the following day. And it seems every time we've had a major consolidation, it's kind of been a turning point. People have sold into it in the gold sector. The gold bounced back about $4 or $5 today. And I still think that the trend in gold is higher, and I think that it's going to be substantially higher. So I think that two-day sell-off was not, you know, something significant. I think it was some profit-taking and some people contemplating that maybe this type of significant news event marked a selling opportunity or a top. I mean, some people might have expected gold to immediately rise based on that merger, and maybe people bought as soon as they heard the news, and then when it wasn't rising, people went to get out, cut their losses, and the selling came in. But I think there's a lot of buying. Also, I've been looking at the dollar against the euro, and the dollar has been trying to move higher, but every time we get above the 120 level against the euro, there is some substantial buying of euros that is coming in, and I think the euro is building a very, very strong base around this 120 level, which is a very statistically significant area, because if you remember when the euro first came onto the scene, the initial exchange rate was around 117 and change. And then the euro proceeded to drop over the next several years down to about 83 cents. Then, of course, at the end of last year, the euro peaked at around 136 and has spent the better part of 2005 either falling against the dollar or now consolidating at this 120 level. But I think what's interesting is that the euro is consolidating at a level slightly above where it first came out. And I think it's establishing a very solid floor here upon which future increases can be built, a very solid base to rally off. And I'm expecting that. Also, again, rather insignificantly, but yesterday, Alan Greenspan raised interest rates again, I think, for the 12th consecutive time. Yet despite 12 interest rate increases, short-term rates are still 4%. And 4% is a very, very low rate of interest, considering that the inflation rate is higher than that. You know, it's higher than 4%. Even the government's own numbers are higher than that. But, you know, interestingly, the way the government spins this thing, this propaganda, last week we got some numbers on the GDP, on the preliminary look at the first quarter GDP. And it was about 3.8%, which is a little bit above the consensus estimate. But interesting, the price numbers, the inflation number, came in annualized at, I think, 3.7% was what they claimed the inflation was. But the core rate, which excludes food and energy, was 1.6. And when I was reading in the newspaper, I was in the airplane, and I had a copy of the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, a couple other papers. And all the headlines were, economy grows without inflation. And everybody referenced the 1.6% core number, that inflation ex food and energy was 1.6%. Not one of these articles that talked about inflation mentioned the actual inflation rate. All they focused on was the core inflation rate, which is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, it makes no sense. But the media has been so dumbed down and is so quick to accept the government's propaganda or spin or whatever word you want to use for it, they're just buying this thing and they're just regurgitating this nonsense about the core. Meanwhile, you know, they're ignoring the price hikes that the post office came out yesterday and announced a 2-cent increase in the price of a postage stamp. You know, prices are going up all around us, and the government is claiming that there's no inflation. Anyway, I know we do have one person on the line. Let's go to the phones. I've got Jack calling from Oregon. How you doing, Jack?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
Good, good.
Question or kind of comment. There is a Fed Reserve study done earlier this year, and the conclusion of the study was that in rich economies, long-term rates never rose after a currency crash. I just want to get your comment on that. And I got this from a newsletter that I won't mention, but it was kind of interesting that...
Yeah, I know the study to which you're referring. It was a Federal Reserve study in which the Federal Reserve was trying to figure out what the implications would be for U.S. interest rates in the event the dollar would crash. And I thought that was interesting mainly because they were studying what would happen if the dollar crashed, which meant they considered it a possibility, I think should be very disturbing to most people who are not acting right now to protect themselves, because if that were to happen, that is a major, major disaster. But I think their conclusions were very erroneous, because I think the examples that they cited of other currency crashes were not really currency crashes. They were, you know, maybe declines in the currency of on the order of 10 to 20%. I mean, none of these economies that they were looking at really had a currency down, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80%. They weren't talking about a collapse. They were talking about a decline. And generally what happened in the wake of one of those declines is that the central banks were able to respond with rather significant increases in interest rates as a result of the sharp decline to shore up confidence. And so what happened is, if your currency dropped 15 or 20%, let's say, and all of a sudden you really jacked up rates, foreigners would look at the resolve of the central bank and say, you know what, the damage is done, the currency's just dropped, there's a great yield to be had, I'm going to move money into that country, and based on these high rates of interest and the fact that the currency has dropped, I'm going to step up. And so what these other countries have seen was their central banks in a position to be able to raise interest rates enough so that foreign creditors would come to the conclusion that the risk rewards were favorable. See, we don't have that ability anymore as a country because America is so completely leveraged. We have so much short-term debt that if we were just to have a 10 or 20% drop in the currency and we were trying to raise rates enough to tell the rest of the world, hey, buy the dollar, you know, we're going to give you a great rate of return, we're really tightening up on our interest rates, the economy would fall into such a severe recession that the politicians would have to print even more money, and they wouldn't have the ability to raise interest rates like that. I mean, you've got everybody with an adjustable rate mortgage. The national debt, you know, just topped $8 trillion in the last month, and we've got this thing financed, you know, with T-bills.
Right, but didn't the U.S. dollar decline, I don't know what the percentage is, maybe 10, 20% a few years ago up until, say, the end of 2004?
Well, yeah, the U.S. dollar declined about a third between 2000, 2001, and 2004. But remember, the U.S. dollar rose by a similar amount between 1996 and 2000. So the dollar is basically where it's been, you know, for the last 10 or 15 years. We haven't really seen a precipitous break in support, which I think is coming. I think it's coming probably next year. And then we're going to see the dollar really start to drop, and then the government is going to have to either come to its rescue with much higher interest rates and, you know, tighter monetary policy and bring back budget deficits, or let it collapse. And the problem is, see, normally, what the U.S. government does in a recession is they try to combat a recession by doing the opposite. They try to ease up on monetary policy. They try to expand money supply, lower interest rates. But that's the exact opposite of what they're going to have to do to defend the currency. And so the government's going to be in a very a difficult position. And which either way they go, the dollar is in trouble and the U.S. economy is in trouble. It's just if they decide to, you know, try to fight the recession and let the dollar collapse, then we could end up with hyperinflation and even a worse recession than we would have had they bit the bullet earlier.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you for your comments.
I think the study is flawed. That's basically the bottom line. Yeah. And so what you got to do is you got to understand that that when the dollar goes down, I mean, the economy is going with it, and interest rates are going sky high. And so what you want to do is make sure that you have your money invested in foreign currencies, and before that happens.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, sure, thanks for the call. You know, that study, I remember talking to some reporters about that study, and I thought the only thing more ridiculous than them doing the study was the conclusions that they came to. But again, you know, these studies were reverse engineered. I mean, what you get from the government is they know what conclusion they want. Basically, they want to try to arrest the fears around the world that the U.S. has something to fear from a major dollar decline. Because everybody knows that if interest rates were to move up dramatically, we're in trouble because we're a nation of debtors. And, you know, I have this argument all the time. You know, I was on this radio show, Mike Norman's Contrarian Show, and every time I go on Mike's show, I mean, we basically just have an argument. But, you know, Mike could not understand the difference between accumulating assets and accumulating liabilities. He couldn't understand that there was a problem. He kept saying, what's the difference if we're running up all these debts? Who cares how much? I mean, you know, I even asked Mike, I talked to him about the fact that, you know, we were the world's biggest creditor nation in 1982, and now we're the world's biggest debtor. And I asked him, what's better? Is it better to be a creditor or better to be a debtor? And he couldn't even answer the question. I mean, obvious. I mean, is it better to be rich or better to be poor? But he couldn't understand the fact that we were a debtor nation. He didn't even agree that we were a debtor nation because he kept talking about all the wealth that we have. And I said, well, you know, that doesn't matter. What makes us a debtor nation is that we owe the world more than the world owes us. And the fact that you can point to the equity in our homes and say we're a wealthy nation because our condos are worth so much, who says that that's what they're worth? You know, it doesn't mean that we can sell them. The problem is, we have mortgages on those condos that need to be serviced. And the interest payments on those mortgages are going to Japan and going to China. And as interest rates go higher and higher and higher, if people's incomes are not sufficient to make those payments, then what are they going to do? It doesn't matter that they have all these real estate assets. If they can't make the payments, they lose those assets. There's their foreclosure. And if all of a sudden, you know, a lot of houses come on the market, what are they worth? You know, the reason that shares of, let's say, eToys were worth $100 a share at one point was because everybody wanted to buy them and nobody wanted to sell them. And then the reason they were worthless a year later is because nobody wanted to buy them and everybody wanted to sell them. And the same thing is going to be true with residential real estate. A bunch of condos in Florida, in Miami, could be worth $1 million a piece today because everybody wants to buy them and nobody wants to sell them. The same group of condos could be worth $200,000 tomorrow because all the people that own them are trying to get rid of them and nobody wants them. You know? And so just because they're worth something today in one circumstance doesn't mean that that's what their value is going to be in the future, especially if circumstances change. I mean, right now when interest rates are low and everybody has the sense that real estate can only go up, nobody wants to sell and nobody has to sell because as prices are rising, people can borrow money against their real estate to make their payments. But once real estate prices start to fall and the general perception is they could fall further, lenders don't want to lend against the collateral because they're worried to get being repaid. Nobody wants to buy if prices are only going to be lower in the future, and as interest rates are rising, the cost of maintaining these condos is more and more expensive. And right now, people have a reason to make their mortgage payments because they have equity and because there's appreciation or expected appreciation. Once home prices or condo prices are falling and owners of these condos are worried more about lower prices in the future, what incentives do they have to continue making mortgage payments, especially as those payments get more and more expensive if they're already underwater? So they're going to try to get rid of their property or they're going to lose their property to default. So trying to say that it's okay that we have all this debt because we have all this home equity is nonsense, because this home equity, it could be gone, and in fact will be gone, when the debt becomes a problem. Because when the debt becomes a problem to service, that's exactly when people need to unload their real estate because they can't afford to make their mortgage payments. But then the question becomes, unload it to who? You know, you can only sell your real estate if there's somebody else who can buy it. And the only way the prices can remain high is if, you know, when a lot of people have to sell, there's an equal number of people who are willing to buy at the same price. And that's not going to happen, of course. And again, you know, one of the things that's the most amazing that I've read is that even the people who are bearish on the housing market, and I read these all the time, people who are talking about, okay, yeah, there's a bubble. You know, 99% of them believe that prices are not going to drop. You know, they think it's like from 1929 that we've reached a permanent plateau of high prices, you know, that prices aren't going to fall, which makes no sense. Because as interest rates rise, right, if prices don't fall, housing just gets more and more expensive. For example, if somebody, and most Americans, when they buy a house, what they do is they find out how much the bank will lend them as far as a monthly payment. And then they'll buy the most expensive house they can afford based on that payment. So if somebody was going to use, let's say, interest-only financing, and they were going to buy a house, and let's say that house, they could buy a house for $500,000, and based on a nothing-down interest-only mortgage, they can afford and get approved for a $500,000 interest-only mortgage. Now, assuming interest rates are 4.5% when they're approved, now let's say interest rates go to 6.5% from 4.5%. Now, that same individual, based on his same income, can only afford to pay about $340,000 for a house based on 6.5% interest than he could based on 4.5%. It's about a 30% reduction in what he can pay. Now, if condos don't go down, if they stay at $500,000, that just means that none of the people who could afford them in the past can afford them now, so they're not going to sell. I mean, what's more likely is that the prices are going to fall back down to where people can now afford them, because houses are only worth what someone else is able and willing to pay for it. So to think that real estate, the interest rates are just going to go higher and higher and higher, and that real estate prices aren't going to drop, doesn't make any sense. I mean, the only way real estate prices won't drop is if nobody sells. But if you can't sell your real estate, what's it worth? I mean, if everybody thinks, yes, real estate prices aren't going to go down because nobody's going to sell, well, then it's just an illusion. But the problem is somebody's going to sell. Everybody's going to not, you know, somebody's going to sell. Somebody's going to die. Somebody's going to have to move. There's going to be a death in the family. Someone's going to have problems making their mortgage payments. And the minute some people have to sell, And they have to sell at $340,000, not $500,000, because the market isn't affording $500,000 anymore because of the higher rates. All of a sudden, prices are down, and guess what? Every house is now worth $340,000 now, not $500,000, because now they're based on comparable sales. And, you know, just like one house selling makes all of them worth more, or one house selling lower brings them all down. So it's very easy to ratchet down these properties. And then all of a sudden, you know, you ratchet down the prices, and somebody bought a house for $500,000 and the last sale is $340,000. If that person had a short-term financing and it comes time to roll over and they try to roll over to another short-term loan, no bank's going to let them roll over because they have a $500,000 mortgage on a $340,000 condo. There's no way they can refinance. They're stuck with whatever the payments go to. And all they can do is walk away from the mortgage, which they probably will if they put nothing down. And they're already $160,000 in the hole. Why struggle to make the payments, especially when there's a plenty of good rentals on the market? Anyway, I know we've got one person on the line. I want to take a quick break, play a commercial for Europe Pacific Capital, and we'll pick up at the other end of the commercial with your phone calls.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that is passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Okay, we're back. And again, the number to call toll-free for your comments or questions is 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. Anyway, I want to take a caller. We've got Eric on the line from Pennsylvania. How you doing, Eric?
Pretty good, Peter. How are you tonight?
I'm well.
I just wanted to get your take on the Rogers Raw Material Fund. I guess I saw a press release that Jim Rogers had.
You know, thanks for bringing that up, because it definitely should be something that I should talk about on the air. We've got letters going out to clients. You know, when Jim Rogers first launched this Raw Material Fund, you know, we were one of the, you know, we helped them break the escrow. We put, you know, at least half the seed capital in to get it off the ground. And, you know, one of the reasons he did this, he had this raw materials fund that he set up for institutions. And it initially had a $500,000 minimum. And I was one of the people that was contacting him saying, you know, I've got a lot of clients that would like to invest in this thing, but they don't have $500,000. Can't you come out with a version that's lower cost? And initially, they tried to do it in the form of a mutual fund, but they couldn't get it approved by the SEC, and then they went the route of the limited partnership, and it got established, and we started putting money into it, and it's just done phenomenally well. I mean, it's, you know, it's clients have made great returns, which for what I thought was, you know, relatively low risk. It was just a non-leveraged program. But what happened, unfortunately, recently, and, you know, I don't know all the details yet. They won't come out maybe until, you know, this lot we get more into the lawsuit. But for some reason, a couple of months ago, Rogers transferred all the money that he had in all the various funds to Revco. And it was some $350 million. About $75 million of it was from the fund, the retail fund, where the Euro Pacific Capital clients are invested. And according to Rogers, that money was supposed to be held in a segregated account for Rogers Raw Material, was not supposed to be commingled with Revco's general assets, and therefore when the bankruptcy court initially freezed these accounts, their position was, no, these assets should not be frozen, they are not general assets of Revco, these assets belong to the Rogers Fund, and they should be returned immediately. And that's what we initially thought, but now it's coming out that there's the potential that that wasn't the case, that Rogers himself may have, in fact, given Revco permission to do this. And that would be the problem, because if Rogers did in fact give them permission, then we are in a position of actually being a creditor of Revco, and we can't get our money back until, you know, as, other than part of a distribution of the assets to the general creditors. Now, if that is the case, then there are two problems there. One, why did Rogers do something like that? Did Rogers have an ulterior motive? Was there some self-serving interest in there? And if that were the case, I mean, that would, you know, that would disturb me quite a bit, because, you know, I've had a lot of faith in Rogers and his reputation and his integrity. And so if that were the case, that would, you know, certainly be a black mark, in my opinion, against Rogers. If, on the other hand, you know, he's genuine and this was a mistake and it was all Revco's doing, then, you know, maybe he still could have had better judgment than to have switched all these assets to Revco, but at least we'll know that it wasn't for any self-serving interest. But I don't know the results of that yet. I have to find out. I know that the Rogers Fund has filed a lawsuit against Revco, and I'm waiting to see. But as far as my clients, are you a shareholder in Rogers?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the best case scenario is the bankruptcy court does rule that these are all assets and they get returned to the fund and there's no problem.
Right. Or as an unsecured creditor, I suppose you're last in line, and I guess that could be a...
I mean, you wouldn't be last. The thing is about Revco is there are a lot of assets there. And even if we were to be a creditor, the chances are that at the most a 10 to 20% hit is what we would take, that we might get back 90 cents on the dollar, worst case maybe 80 cents on the dollar, which is still, you know, it's nothing to be happy about to take a hit. For most of our clients, they would still have significant profits in the investment because most people have a lot more than a 20% gain.
Right.
But, you know, but still, I mean, it's still not, you know, I mean, it's a bad deal. And if it turns out that we are unsecured creditors because of something that Rogers himself did, we might have action against Rogers, you know. Also, there's a question of whether or not some of this might fall under the protection of SIPC, and I'm not really sure yet, Securities Investors Protection from Allman Price, which was the firm, the broker-dealer that was distributing it. And there might be a SIPC protection. At least it goes whether it's up to $100,000 or $500,000 in this case, I'm not sure. So there might be the ability, if we are hit with a loss, to recoup some of our losses in a legal action or to recoup it through SIPC. And if we got made whole through SIPC, then, you know, we'd be fine. In the meantime, the fund is still exposed to the Rogers Index, so any money that we have invested is still rising and falling. But the fund is sending out a letter today, which is basically giving shareholders the option of moving their money from the Rogers Index to a cash position so that the dollar value of their investment would remain fixed from that point. And it would no longer fluctuate with the index up or down.
Yeah, that seems like you would probably want to stay in it then and get the...
No, I mean, we're leaning towards now looking at it, thinking that maybe we should advise people to get out of it, because if these funds are frozen and they can't get at them...
Right, but
if the positions start to move in certain directions, that the fund gets margin calls that they can't meet... you know, there could be some forced liquidations, or I don't know, it might be dangerous to be invested in the index itself if they don't have access to all the money. You know, because remember, most of the money is in these T-bills. We only put up a small fraction as margin. But the whole fund itself, the whole initial concept of the Rogers Fund was to be non-leveraged, a very conservative way to get into securities. But it might be that if we maintain exposure, and especially if enough other people say, I don't want in it, and they want out, I mean, I don't know, I don't really know. So, I mean, part of me just says, look, better safe than sorry. Let's just secure our position, go to cash, know how much money we have, and then see where we are.
Right.
But we're going to be preparing a letter. I'm going to look at it and try to figure out, you know, what to advise my clients to do. And then ultimately it's up to each individual shareholder or unit holder to decide what they want to do. But the one thing no one can do right now is get their money.
Right, exactly.
Nobody can say, send me a check.
Right, exactly.
And so, I mean, and that's the unfortunate thing. Not that anybody was going to get a check anyway. But now that this has happened, and to me, you know, what upsets me about it is I looked at this investment as relatively conservative. And it was relatively conservative right up until the time that Rogers transferred everything to Revco. And either Revco was at fault and was fraudulent in the way they coded these assets, or Rogers deliberately allowed them to do this in exchange for what, I don't know. But I'm still waiting to find out what it is. I'm hoping, you know, for my clients, myself, and certainly for the integrity of Rogers, that it is all Revco's doing,
right?
And that they pulled a fast one. Rogers didn't know about it, and the bankruptcy court will see that, and we'll be okay. But I don't know for sure that that's the case, and anything is possible, you know. And people are starting to talk now about rumors that I'm reading that maybe it wasn't a mistake, that maybe Rogers knew about it and had some kind of reason. But again, you know, I don't know for sure, so I can't say.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah, you know, it's always troubling when an investment that I had recommended to clients potentially goes bad or has a problem. And, you know, this could be a case. And it's a product that we feature on our website that we've been recommending to clients for years. And it has performed extremely well. And it would be very unfortunate if there were any losses for clients, particularly clients who invested very recently. And if there was a 10 or 20% loss because we were general creditors of Revco, then those people might experience losses. And it's also unfortunate because it was a great product. And I think that if the fund was still intact, that it would have substantial returns for many, many years to come, because I still believe that we are in the beginning of a bull market, of a long-term bull market in commodities. And if ultimately, if I decide based on what all the evidence is that I don't want to have my clients in this fund because of a problem I have with Rogers, then we will recommend it. And there are alternatives. I mean, in fact, Rogers' ex-business partner has launched a fund already which is almost identical to the Rogers fund. And in fact, he was very adamantly opposed to Rogers going with Revco, which is probably one of the reasons that he set up his own fund. So there are some alternatives if it comes to that, if we decide that we need to get out of the fund and move into another product. But we're going to have to wait and see what happens. But anyway, I hope that answers your questions. And as I said, we're going to have some letters in the mail and make some official recommendations as to whether or not people should avail themselves of this special opportunity to at least move their money to the sidelines, have some fixed dollar amount that they know is theirs, and no longer have exposure to the Rogers Index, which I don't know if there would be some problems there resulting from leverage or failure to meet margin calls or anything like that. Anyway, we've got a call on the line, John from Massachusetts. Go ahead, John.
Hey, I just want to say thanks for putting the show on. I think it's very interesting and informative. I would recommend that you state your name and where you're transmitting from, because I've never heard the show before. And my question is, how do you think any economic changes in the value of the dollar and the real estate market could affect poor people who are not in debt, who work, and how they may poise themselves to remain safe and free in the future? Thank you.
Are you listening on the shortwave?
Yes.
Yeah, well, you know, I do this show every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I've been doing it for about a year. You can also listen to all of the archive version on my website at www.europac.net. And I'm broadcasting on a frequency 5.07 megahertz. And it's once a week. It's heard on shortwave. I think it's also rebroadcast on Saturdays at 11:30 Eastern, 8:30 p.m. Pacific, on frequency 9.32 megahertz. In answer to your question, I mean, I think everybody is going to be hurt by the collapsing value of the dollar, and in particular, the poor people. And certainly, being free from debt is not going to help you. In fact, having debt, at least fixed rate debt, the one benefit will be that debt will be, you know, repudiated through inflation.
Right.
Real problem for the poor, the working poor, is going to be that the value of their wages is going to fall dramatically, so that when they go to spend their money, it's, you know, they're not going to get very much for it. So people, the average wage earner in the United States is going to find that his standard of living becomes dramatically diminished. And things that Americans used to take for granted as being able to afford will all of a sudden be out of reach for many, many families. And people are going to just rediscover what it means to have to deny themselves things, to have to go without things, to how to be conservative. People are going to learn, you know, that they turn off the lights in the rooms that they're not in, that they don't run the heating or the air conditioning, that they don't, you know, just, you know, joyride in their car, that people are going to have to conserve energy. They're going to have to, you know, people are not going to just, you know, throw things out. You know, if their socks have a hole in them, they're not going to just go buy new ones. They're going to have to get a needle and thread and figure out how to sew them up. I mean, you know, people are going to start doing things, growing vegetables in their backyards or doing things to save money, carpooling. You know, people are going to have to get used to a much lower standard of living. You know, a lot of people who are retired right now are going to have to go back to work. You know, it's unfortunate, but that's what's going to have to happen. And Americans are going to have to go back to productive work again. We're not going to be able to just pretend we're working because in some service sector jobs that don't produce things. We're going to have to go back to real, you know, rolling up our sleeves and making stuff. And so it's going to be a very difficult transition for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to ease that transition, to ease that burden, is if you have financial assets right now that you can at least get out of the dollar and to accumulate some of the assets that are going to, you know, going to rise in value and that are going to be the recipient of all the purchasing power that Americans lose.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, if you're working paycheck to paycheck and you don't have the means, then, you know, it's just going to be tough.
Yeah, what about silver, though? That's easier to buy on a lower budget. And my other question would be, historically, I think that in the 20s or 30s, I've heard that they outlawed the personal possession of gold, bullion. And do you expect something like that to happen again?
I don't know what's going to happen. I do know that in general times of economic distress, is when governments tend to act like that. It's like when a cat has got his back to a wall, you know, a lion has got his back to a wall, he might lash out, you know. I mean, that's what happens with politicians. You know, when their backs are to the wall, they look for scapegoating, and they generally grab power, and they use the crisis as a soapbox. You know, I mean, Adolf Hitler rose to power in the aftermath of the hyperinflation in the Weimar Republic in Germany, and Adolf Hitler was democratically elected in Germany. He was a socialist, and he was elected, and the reason that the population was able to be swayed by his rhetoric was because of the problems. And so when you have a country in chaos and distress like we will be in, there was always a chance that you get that kind of reaction by the government. And so I'm very fearful of what the U.S. government might do in respect to confiscating wealth and assets and limiting individual liberties and rights. I mean, because the extent that they do that during good times, I mean, the government is constantly encroaching on our liberties and overstepping its bounds, even during good times. So, you know, I can imagine what might happen in the future when we're going through this period of economic distress.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons that when we recommend gold and silver, we recommend the Perth Mint Certificate Program, where we're helping our clients buy gold and have it stored safely and at no cost in a government-owned mint in Australia. So to the extent that the U.S. government does confiscate gold, they're not going to get that gold. And unless you voluntarily turn it over to them, they won't be able to get it, you know, because it's going to be out of the country, and there's no way they can force you to bring it back.
Yeah, how do you think the coming economic changes are going to affect Canada?
Well, again, I mean, Canada, you know, is a big trading partner of the United States, and so to the extent that they do a lot of business with the United States, that's going to hurt because, you know, America is going to be very poor, and they're not going to be trading a lot. On the other side of the coin, Canada is very, very rich in natural resources. These natural resources are going to get more and more valuable, particularly to Asian economies. And so their trade with America is going to suffer, but their trade with Asia is going to pick up. And overall, I mean, whether it's a net benefit or positive or a push, you know, I'm not sure, but I do believe that the relative economic positions will switch, where Canada will be the more prosperous nation relative to the United States. And, you know, so we're going to be the poor neighbor to the south. They're not going to be our poor neighbor to the north.
Mm-hmm.
And you might see more and more Americans looking to move up to Canada for employment opportunities. Kind of the way people in Mexico have been looking to the United States. I mean, it might even come to a point where the Mexicans are having to erect a barrier to keep Americans from crossing the border to go down to Mexico. Who knows?
Yeah, even if I knew what was going to happen, I'd be afraid to say it on the radio, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot, like, and America, if you look at what happens, take a look at what happened, look at that, remember that footage, you know, in New Orleans or with the flooding and all the looting and what was going on there? Imagine that happening all across the country. That's how Americans act in a crisis. Imagine what happens if all of a sudden, you know, all around the country in the inner cities, all of a sudden, the unemployment or the welfare checks or Social Security checks are not coming, or they're coming and there's no value there. There's nothing in the stores. There's no food to be had. I mean, the trucks aren't coming into the cities because the farmers aren't willing to accept, you know, collapsing currency for their crops, and you know, we can't afford the energy to move the, you know, I don't know, who knows? I mean, if the cities can't afford to pay the police, or the police don't want to work because they can't get paid, or their paychecks aren't worth anything, I mean, who knows what might happen? I mean, because you could take a look at what happens in a crisis, and, you know, there's a lot of civil unrest, and, you know, I don't think that the people in the United States are the same as the people that lived in this country during the Great Depression. I don't think we have the moral character. I don't think we're as civil a society as we were back then. And so, you know, it's nervous. It's definitely something to be nervous about.
Well, it's like a purge that happens periodically, and some people would think that the greater powers want this purge to happen so they can get people to work harder, and
anybody wants this
oligarchy and then a lower class, not a middle class.
I also don't believe in any kind of conspiracy theories that there are some bankers orchestrating the decline of America or somebody wants this to happen. I mean, I just think that collectively a lot of people are acting in their own self-interest. But I think that, you know, this is, you know, no different than any other, you know, crazy concept that the masses have bought into. And the United States is no exception. And many economic powers have risen and fallen for the same reason that America is about to fall. And, you know, we've been
foreclosures everywhere. They're going to have a big changing of who owns the land everywhere.
We'll see. We'll see. But we became a great nation because we had limited government. We had, you know, since government was small, individuals were big. You know, by limiting the power of government, individuals were able to flourish and entrepreneurs were able to produce. And we produced and saved our way to becoming the wealthiest country in the world. And then, like other wealthy countries before us, we've borrowed and consumed our way into becoming one of the poorest as far as being a large net debtor. And just like every other country that has become wealthy and then squandered their wealth, you know, we're going to suffer the same fate. It's just that a lot of people don't understand because they look at how much fun we're having squandering our wealth and they think everything is great because we're still out there spending. But they don't realize that the money that we've been spending is about to, you know, we're about to use it all up and then we're stuck.
Like I heard you say earlier on this show, you were stating on someone else's show, there's a big difference between an accumulation of liabilities and assets. And I think you're correct that most people aren't thinking of what they have as liabilities and assets.
Yeah, well, the point I tried to make on that show was if foreigners are accumulating assets and we're accumulating liabilities, in the future, they're going to get to spend all the interest on their assets and we're going to be struggling to pay debt on those liabilities. And so all the consumption that we've had today is going to come at the expense of lower consumption in the future. And the other countries that have been under-consuming and saving, well, they're going to get to consume a lot more in the future because they're going to consume all the interest that we have to pay them. Anyway, I thank you for the call. And
please keep reminding everyone what your website is and what your name is so that new people who tune in, like I have, will be able to keep learning about this.
Okay, well, great. As I said, visit my website at www.europac.net.
Europac, P-A-C?
U-R-O-P-A-C.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much, and have a great night.
And let's actually play that commercial one more time, letting everybody know how to get a hold of us, and then we'll pick it up for the last segment.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro-Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that has passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Okay, and this is Peter Schiff, and I guess that might be a good bit of advice from the last caller, so maybe I should make a point of mentioning the frequency. But anyway, we are broadcasting on shortwave 5.07 megahertz, and the show can be heard live every Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific, and the show is repeated on 9.32 megahertz on Saturday at 11:30 p.m. Eastern and 8:30 p.m. Pacific. And any of you that want to tell your friends about the program if they missed it live, all the programs are available to listen on demand on my website at www.europac.net. Europac.net. Also, I encourage everybody to go to my website, researchreport1.com. Just spell out the words researchreport1.com to download my free report on the powerful case for investing in foreign equities. And also, we did launch, I think it was last week, the initial issue of our newsletter, The Global Investor. If you did not receive your free copy of this newsletter via email, it's either because we don't have your email address or there was a problem. But if you want to get this newsletter, make sure that you get a hold of us and we have your email address, because we are not mailing hard copies of the newsletter. The newsletter is distributed exclusively via the internet, and in order to get it, we've got to have your email address. There are no hard copies that are being mailed. It's strictly an online newsletter, and we are making it available free of charge. And that's one of the reasons that we have to do it on the internet, because it doesn't cost us anything. You know, when you're sending out a physical newsletter, you've got to actually print it, you've got to pay for that, and then you've got to pay to mail it. Now that the post office has raised the price of a stamp yet again, you know, it makes it more and more expensive to distribute an actual hard copy newsletter. So we're making it internet only, but we're not charging for it. But anyway, the first issue went out last week, and hopefully the next issue will be out in another month or so. Anyway, we've got another call on the line, John from Los Angeles. Go ahead, John.
Hello, Peter.
Are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yes, John, it's Peter Schiff. You're on the air.
Yeah, pleased to talk to you. I'm interested in what kind of custodial risk one assumes when buying foreign stocks through your company.
Well, I mean, we clear through a company called Pershing, and Pershing is the largest clearing firm in the United States. And so the risk that you have by allowing Pershing to custody assets for you would be the risk of Pershing going bankrupt. And Pershing is owned by the Bank of New York, which is the oldest bank in the United States. So they've got a strong parent company, and they are the largest independent clearing firm in the United States. So it's not impossible for them to go bankrupt, but they're no more likely to go bankrupt probably than, you know, big firms like Merrill Lynch or, you know, Morgan Stanley are. So doing business with me is at least as safe as doing business with those firms.
Okay, is there any addition for account insurance?
Oh, yeah, and of course you do have, the accounts are covered up to $500,000 through SIPC. But it's my opinion that if Pershing were to go bankrupt, and if you were to reclaim your insurance, that would be highly, I don't think it would amount to anything. I think the environment that would lead Pershing to go under would probably mean that, let's say you had $200,000 or $300,000 with me, and the dollar collapsed, and the whole economy, everything collapsed. That two or three hundred thousand could be worth $2 or $3 million or $20 million. And then if we go under and the government writes you a check for $500,000, big deal. Big deal, right?
Right.
So, I mean, I think if it really does hit the fan and Pershing were to go under, I don't think the government's $500,000 insurance was going to be worth very much.
Okay, same sort of question for the Perth Mint. Now, if they're selling silver and not charging fees to store it, it would seem to me that they must have many, many, many tons of silver sitting around. Is it audited? Has anyone ever seen?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I mean, and they're actually already talking about not doing any more silver. They think they've got all the silver they need, and they might actually start charging for silver relatively soon. The people that are already in there would be grandfathered, and they'd have it in. But any moment now, the Perth Mint might no longer offer free storage on silver. But the reason that they offer free storage, and the reason this whole concept came in, because some people hear about it and they think, well, there must be some kind of scam. Why are they doing it for free? Well, the reason was, since they're a mint, right, they want to have an inventory of gold and silver on hand at all times in the form of coins and bars. Because what happens is, if I'm a customer of the mint, and I come in and I bring them a hunk of gold bullion, and I say, hey, I want you to assay this, and I want to buy some of your coins. I want to turn it into coins. If they had to actually take that particular, you know, ingot and refine it, I don't know how long it would take. Maybe the guy couldn't come back and get his coins for a couple of weeks. I don't know how long the process takes. But if they could just take that gold, you know, with their right hand, and then with their left hand, hand them the equivalent in coins, right, quicker, it makes them more efficient. So what they decided is, well, rather than going out and borrowing a bunch of money to fund their own inventory of gold and silver so that they can always have gold and silver on hand, they came up with a concept of, wait a minute, why don't we just store other people's gold and silver who have it anyway? That way we can have it here. And then if somebody wants coins or bars, we'll just have it, and we'll store other people's. And so the whole concept is, you're allowing the Perth Mint to use your gold, but it can never leave the mint. You know, so if 5,000 ounces of gold are going to be shipped out, it's because 5,000 ounces were put in a different form. But the same amount of gold is always there. And it is audited by the government of Western Australia, because that government, which owns the mint, requires that mint to have physically on premises at all times all the gold that is in that unallocated program, and all the silver and all the platinum. So it has to be there. And not only is it audited, but the government, it's also reinsured through Lloyd's of London. So you've got reasons, because the government has a liability there. They make sure that the gold is there. I mean, this is not a situation where they can lend your gold out. They can use the gold on premises, but it can never leave the premises. And so what this enabled the Perth Mint to have was a way to have a free inventory and save on the cost of keeping inventory. Plus, they do make a little bit of money in the program. They do have a small spread between the bid and the ask. They make a few bucks on the transactions. So it's a good business for them.
All right.
Yeah, once they get to the point where they're storing more silver than they have demand for, then it becomes difficult to store it. And at some point, they're going to say, no, we have enough physical silver in inventory. We don't want any more. And then they would start charging for it. And that's going to happen. I mean, at some point, they're going to start charging, I think, for all the metals. But for now, we're still able to offer the program free of charge. And from what they've told me, you know, once they go to a charge, the people who are already in are in. They're not going to start, I don't think they're going to start charging the people who got in when it was free.
Well, all right. Well, thank you very much.
All right, and for information on the Perth program, you know, you can call us or just go to our website under the Perth Mint and read about the program. And I think it's a great way to buy gold and silver. And remember, the only reason we're selling the Perth Mint is because I wanted to provide gold and silver to my clients, and I looked around for a vehicle that I thought was the best way for me to do it, and I chose Perth.
Very good. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Yeah, let me take a quick look if we have any callers on the line. We don't. We've only got about, 5 or 6 minutes left of the program. Potentially we could take one more call if you call right away. The number to call is 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. Yeah, I've always recommended, you know, an allocation towards gold. Some people will say, you know, given my outlook, why don't I just recommend everything in gold, you know, because I'm, you know, so negative on the dollar and paper currencies. They say, you know, a lot of the investments that I recommend, if I'm recommending the euro or the Swiss franc or the New Zealand dollar or Singapore dollar, those are paper currencies too. They're not backed by gold. I mean, and the reason is, you know, I don't know for sure how long it's going to take for the dollar to collapse. At this point, I think we're very close. I think the dollar's going to collapse next year, maybe the following year. But you know what? I could be wrong. You know, a lot of people have been predicting this type of gloom and doom for 10 or 20 years, and a lot of these things haven't happened. And a lot of people have been surprised by the resiliency here or the world's willingness to subsidize America. And it's always possible that this could take longer than I think. If that is the case, and you have too much of your wealth tied up in bullion, you know, you're not going to be getting any kind of a return. You're not getting much of a dividend. But by investing in a conservative portfolio of foreign stocks that are paying 7, 8, 9% dividends, it doesn't matter. Even if I'm 5 years too early, even if I'm 10 years too early, you know, the opportunity cost is not there because you're getting a better return by investing prudently outside the United States, waiting for the dollar to collapse, than other people are who are investing in the United States who are more clueless to what's going on. And of course, I've said this many times, the longer it takes for the dollar to collapse, the bigger the collapse is going to be, and the more important that it's going to end up being that you've invested outside the dollar. Because the problem is, the longer this goes on, the deeper the hole we dig for ourselves. The more debt we accumulate as a nation, the more of our economy, our legitimate, you know, wealth-producing sector, you know, manufacturing, the more of that is lost. The more of our technology and know-how is lost, and the more difficult it's going to be for us to return to economic viability. So the sooner the dollar collapses and we can start getting back on the right track, we can start filling in the hole, the better. Because right now we're still digging and making the hole deeper. And, you know, so the deeper we get, you know, we increase the likelihood that we'll never get out. You know, so it's very important that people get their money out of the dollar now. You know, potentially the collapse will happen right away, but maybe it's going to take a long time. But the longer it takes, the more important it is that you do this. But in the meantime, if we're invested in a conservative portfolio of dividend-paying foreign stocks, we're going to get a good return on our investments while we're waiting this thing out. You know, and, you know, it doesn't matter if we're too early. Because a lot of people ask me that question. They say, when is the dollar going to collapse? And I always come back with the same answer. I have no idea. And if I knew, A, I wouldn't tell you, and B, I wouldn't be working for a living. You know, if I knew the exact point that the dollar was going to collapse, I'd keep my mouth shut, and I'd become a zillionaire. And I wouldn't be doing a radio show in the evening, and I wouldn't be looking for clients. But I know that it's going to collapse eventually. That I know. I'm smart enough to figure that out. And so what I'm going to do is, since I don't know how much time I've got, right? I mean, the dollar could collapse tomorrow morning, in which case those of you who are listening to this program who haven't sent me any money are just out of luck. You missed your opportunity. But it could happen tomorrow morning, or it could happen in 2 years or 5 years or 10 years. I have no idea. All I want to do is help save as many people as I can before it happens. I want to help as many people who understand this problem, to show them that there's a solution, that there's a way to preserve what wealth they've accumulated, to the extent they've accumulated any. I mean, if you haven't accumulated any wealth, then I can't help you. But if you have savings, if you have investments, I can do something. Because the money that you have right now represents consumption, future consumption. It represents, you know, money that you could have spent, but you chose not to. And you want to make sure that you're keeping your savings in a currency that's not going to collapse in value. Otherwise, you might as well spend it right now. What's the point of saving? Anyway, I know we're running out of time. This is the last minute, so I thank everybody for listening. Once again, this has been Wall Street Unspun. I'm broadcasting every Wednesday live at 5.07 megahertz, Wednesdays 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. You can give us a call toll-free at 800-727-7922, 800-727-7922. Visit us online at www.europac.net. Download my research report at researchreport1.com, researchreport1.com. Look for our newsletter, The Global Investor. And once again, I'll speak to you all again next week, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Thanks for listening. So long.